Blog Talk Radio.
As the tears are falling from my face, with all my fears I long for your embrace. How am I gonna carry on and be the one you lead it on when I'm falling down? Now the tears are falling from your face.
You know, the only thing that's missing, the only thing that's missing in that song is, what is the new Space Force song? I have no idea. We need to research that, and we need to add that. I'm sure they've got a song. Every branch has a song. You got the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, and now you have the Space Force. And, you know, there we are. So anyways, welcome to another episode of Continue Mission. Now, we are going to have a good conversation today, and we're going to talk about, now, number one, today is Medal of Honor Day. It is. It is Medal of Honor Day, and I had I actually had sent Rich a message about that. We're going to talk about the history of the Medal of Honor, but we're also going to talk about the tough and rugged, you know, veterans of World War II, you know, and how they grew up and you know, what was, you know, what life was like in the Depression era, and a little bit about, you know, when you start to see this, you can kind of understand, you know, how it was that they were able to, you know, fight that war, you know, World War II, and you know, build industries. I mean, I'm talking about out of scratch. You know, I live in a community near Point Pleasant, West Virginia, and it, like many places, it just blossomed into wartime industry. They made ships here and TNT here and bombs and explosives and you name it. It was, you know, all here. You know, there were military, there was a military base near Camp Conley. Thousands of soldiers, you know, went through there and trained to go. They actually were there during World War I as well. So that base has been there. It had been there for a very long time. It's not a base now. It's a great big field that I metal detect. And sometimes we find some pretty cool things out there, mainly 30-06 cartridges from, could have been World War I or II. Because they both used that 30-06 round. So, but we found some other things as well, some buttons definitely from World War I era shirts, blouses. And that's been a lot of fun. But these people were tough. Man, they were tough. And they just were able to just make stuff. And I can remember, you know, now my grandparents grew up in the Depression. They were very young. They were too young for World War II, but they were right at the right age for the Korean War. And but the things that they told me, you know, how they would save and how nothing got thrown away. Everything was just, you know, you reused everything. I mean, and then they told me about the war effort where they would even peel the aluminum foil off of, you know, chewing gum wrappers and things. And they would make these huge, you know, tin foil balls. And they would take them down to the scrapyard for the war effort. All of it was for the war effort. And they would just go find all kinds of just junk and just dragging out. So, and of course they were melting it down and turning it into everything from, you know, bombs to guns to bullets to aircraft to tanks to ships. So really, really cool. So we're going to have a discussion about that as well. But I want to talk a little bit about what's going on in the world right now. Obviously, we still have the issue with, you know, the Russians in the Ukraine. And you know, I have ran into some really pro-Russian people on LinkedIn. LinkedIn has become a Russian troll paradise. And if you publish anything or post anything, you know, talking about the war in the Ukraine, you know, it's amazing some of the responses that you get from these folks. And a lot of them are coming out of Serbia, you know, so I guess I didn't know that they leaned that heavy in support of Putin. But, you know, they do. They absolutely do. And it's amazing to hear them talk about the U.S., you know, and how they basically blame us for 80%, us and Great Britain. They say that the United States and Great Britain are responsible for 80% of the crap that goes on around the world, 80%. You know, totally forgetting about the Chinese, the North Koreans, the Russians. But let's not forget the Iranians. And then let's take all those terrorist groups, Hamas and, you know, I can't even think of all of them right now, Al-Qaeda and you know, to name a few. I mean, I'm just kind of drawing a blank right now, but so many splinter groups out there that are creating chaos, and they're very upset about, you know, the war crimes tribunal against their Serbian leaders who committed some horrific genocide, you know, during the Balkan Wars, you know, in the mid-1990s. Bad, I mean, but they don't think that it was bad. They think that, you know, Kosovo and Bosnia and they all should have just basically accepted their rule. And they had no problem with taking people out in the woods and gunning them down, much like what you saw that the Nazis did. I mean, that's a fact. That stuff really happened. And it's just odd to see people defending that. There's a lot of crazy out there. You know, I would say looking at a Facebook page dedicated to Matt Maupin, who was, you know, a truck driver, Ohio reserve unit. And he was captured and, you know, and he wasn't found for 4 years, you know, and of course, he had been killed. He was 12 miles. They found his body 12 miles from where, you know, he was captured at. They had him on, you know, video and took pictures of him. You know, they murdered him. And on this Facebook page, you see this guy, you know, from Iraq that's just, you know, making all kinds of, you know, jackass comments and stuff. And it's like, you know, I don't understand it. But I'll tell you what, when I see things like that, you know, look, I don't carry any guilt for what I did in the war. I don't. None whatsoever. And I will tell you why, because I had no malice in my heart, no hatred, you know, for individuals. But when I see guys like that carrying on, you know, mocking the family of this fallen warrior who was murdered after he was captured by these thugs. You know, I don't feel so bad about squeezing off 100, 200 rounds, you know, into a building full of those suckers now. I really don't. It sounds bad to say that, folks. It really does. But when you see that, that's the kind of evil and wickedness. And there's no negotiating with them, okay? And I know Father Michael's going to come on here, and we're going to talk about this as well. But look, you can't negotiate with the devil, period. And when people do stuff like that, they are full of the devil. If you want to try to hurt a mourning mother, I hope you never come to the United States, because I'll slap the paste out of your mouth. I'm telling you. And probably did slap this guy around or something. Who knows? You know, somebody did, because, you know, he was probably one of them that fell to his knees the minute that the bullet started shooting. And now that we're all out of there, you know, he's making his, you know, 15 minutes of fame on Facebook. But it's amazing to see that. And then to see the LinkedIn comments and just the utter ignorance that goes on. You know, I mean, the ignorance about our economy, the ignorance of people thinking that, you know, look, we can talk about the Green New Deal. We can talk about all these things. I've never been a fan of the Green New Deal. Okay. Never been a fan. And why? Look at what's going on in the Ukraine right now. Okay, because we gave up our stance as an energy-independent nation and exporting fuel to the European countries, you know, and because we just, you know, supported the Nordstrom pipeline that the Russians now control the energy in Europe. They do. They control it. And if they hadn't controlled it, they probably wouldn't have made this bold move. Now, they're paying a tremendous price for it. And now you've even got soldiers that are committing fratricide. You know, they're killing their officers. And people are pushing back. So, you know, who knows? This might set into motion the removal of Vladimir Putin, and we might not have to fire a shot. But I always, you know, I was watching this, you know, how they were, the Ukrainians are really putting it to them. I mean, they, you know, I don't know how they blew the ship up out there, but they did. They really put it to them good. And I watched a group of Ukrainian citizens with Molotov cocktails. They took out two Russian BMPs, and they did it relatively quickly. And I'm thinking, boy, you guys, if you think that's bad, wait till an A-10 Thunderbolt comes screaming down from 10,000 feet up and fills you full of, you know, 30 Mike Mike. You know what I mean? It's just, it's unbelievable. And, I think that for me, when I see this, all these years we trained for the Russians, and it's kind of like they're really not all that. You know, now they've got the nuclear bomb, you know, they got nuclear missiles and stuff, and I don't doubt they would use them. You know, as a matter of fact, they had some interviews going on with people overseas in Russia. And, you know, about 60% of the Russians are okay with launching an initial nuclear strike on America. So I'm thinking to myself, how does that happen? You know, it's just, I mean, we went through the whole Cold War thing, and it's, they all seemed so happy when the wall came down in Berlin, but I guess they're bored now. They want to do something else. I don't know. That's the mark of this generation, I guess. I'm bored. Let's do something else. So anyways, we're going to bring Rich and Father Mike on. But, yeah. So what do you guys think? You know, here's the, you know, obviously, you know, Father Mike, you know, I mean, it's, you know, I know you're going to have something to say about, you know, the Iraqis and the Russian trolls that make these horrific comments. But, you know, is it bad for me to not have any guilt or remorse? I mean, I've taken this all to the Lord and prayed on it many, many times, and it's not like it's a battle that I haven't already had. But when I see things like that, it makes me feel less and less. I don't even think about it anymore. You know, I mean, what's your thoughts on all that?
I think it's important that we acknowledge there's such an entity as evil and demonic spirits and things that are motivating people and infesting their thoughts. And I think we have to start there. And as you said earlier, you can't negotiate with the devil. And you have evildoers, people that are bent on death and destruction. And the only thing they really respect is strength. And certainly we make our peace with God for whatever we do, even some of the hatred in our hearts for people that have wronged us. But as an agent of the state, it's not a personal vendetta. And certainly we all have to make peace with God, because war isn't the highest thing that we can do as far as trying to live peaceably. But I recently saw the city they're going to try to build with hardly any police officers, and everybody's trying to establish a utopia. And as I mentioned, the reason why the Christians, and especially St. Augustine, established the just war tradition is because they know that people are sinful. They know that there's a time for war and a time for peace. So terrible to see. We want to hate the sin and not the sinner. And God is the only one who really condemns and judges everlastingly. But I think that we have to. If you read some of the Psalms, you know, David talks about, you know, hating those, you know, because they hate the Lord. And they hate what is right and what is good. So I don't think you're gloating over anything, James. I think you're simply seeing that there's evil and there's good, and we better be on the right side.
Yeah, that's, you know, for me, it's just, you know, it's not a gloating thing, but it's definitely not a guilt thing. And and I have had people that really have looked at me and said, you know, how do you sleep, and how do you just, you know, because there's so many people that deal with nightmares years and years after, you know, I mean, guys are still having nightmares about Vietnam, but I've had some nightmares. Don't get me wrong, but, you know, you can ask my wife, I sleep pretty good. You know what I mean? But I pray, I fold my hands, I pray a little, you know, and ask God, you know what I mean, to direct my thoughts and stuff. And I think that being tired, because, you know, you've worked all day, that's a benefit too. And,
but you've made your peace with God, and that's a clear conscience. You've asked God for forgiveness for whatever you have done and whatever I have done, irrespective of what's been done in war. And I think that's where we can have a clear conscience and a peace because of everything that Jesus died on the cross for. But I think the danger would be to be hard-hearted. I know Rich has been saying to us that years from now you might want to go to Iraq and meet some people from the other side, and it wouldn't be a personal thing. It was just business, and you could understand, you know, what they were involved in and what they were doing in the same way as you were following orders and defending your country and stuff. And I think we have to find our humanity in that. I don't think that when Jesus talks about loving our enemies and praying for those who despitefully use us, as he did while he was being murdered, is a weakness. I think it's a strength. Did you read the book Unbroken? Or see the movie?
I saw the movie, and it was very powerful.
Right, and the one Japanese soldier would not see him, but he kind of reconciled a lot of things by, you know, kind of facing his demons, if you will. And and it wasn't something he was doing like a personal vendetta. He was being a patriot and defending his country. So I think if we put those in those categories, you know, now we met people, some of our relatives that were World War II veterans, and I had many, you know, wouldn't buy something maybe made in Germany or Japan or whatever. But I think we've gotten beyond just hating a people. We all have sin. We're all sinful. And there are some things that had to be done. Even people like police officers that have had to arrest and put people in prison and maybe shoot people. You know, they don't hate them. I mean, you know from personal experience.
Yeah.
They're just doing what's right, and the other person was doing what's wrong.
And we see so much wickedness out here. I mean, there's just so much wickedness. You know, this young man was brutally beaten and murdered, and they finally caught the thugs that did it. And you know, it's just a sad situation. You know, this is the second young man that has been murdered, you know, in a year. You know, last Easter, you know, a young boy that, he was a young man. He was, you know, 22 years old, went to school with my kids. I mean, there were two guys broke into his house and, you know, and he fought them like crazy. And they killed him. You know, I mean, they shot him, you know, five or six times. It was unbelievable. You know, but it's a sad situation.
Is it amazing, though, where we've seen some atrocious things? I was reading a story yesterday, and a young man was drunk, and he was with another young man. And the young man who was not drunk or wasn't driving got killed, and the person who was driving did not. And I guess the father pleaded for leniency, you know, that he wasn't intentionally trying to kill. This whole chapter I was reading was on how important it is to forgive, to release yourself, because the next story they told was about a woman whose sister and her husband and baby were murdered, and the person was not remorseful. They never admitted it until she wrote a letter to him. I guess they made a movie about it in prison, you know, kind of sharing her forgiveness. And he finally admitted what he did and was remorseful. And sometimes if we extend forgiveness, you know, I know the person that was probably responsible for my daughter's death, I dealt with that, you know, thinking I should go visit him. He was in prison. He died a year later. But I knew that I had to peel that onion, because you can't live with that. It's toxic. And so, you know, when you talk about evildoers and wickedness, I'm with you. But when God says vengeance is mine, says the Lord, we can't deal with it righteously. Only God can.
Sure.
It doesn't mean it's not a time for war.
Yeah. No. I mean, and look, I mean, sometimes, you know, I have been told this, and, you know, that, you know, God will deliver your enemies into your hands, you know, at times. I mean, but I don't know, Rich, what do you think about
that? God, he thought they delivered King Saul into his hands, but David showed honor. You know, he cut the bottom of his robe, but he still showed honor. He could have killed him, and everybody around him was saying, David, God's given Saul. Recognize that Saul was the anointed of the Lord. And then Saul cries out, David, you're more righteous than I. That's the higher ground. And we know David, you know, killed 100 guys, you know, and gave their foreskins to Saul just to prove that he could be a son-in-law. So he was quite a warrior.
My goodness. You know, I mean, it's a you know, that's amazing. That is, it's, but Rich, what do you think about that?
Well, I want to remind Father Michael that he's the one that told me that when David was on his deathbed, his last instructions was to go kill that guy that insulted him a while
back.
Right. Okay,
that's right.
All right, and as you told me, whenever most people gloss over that, you go, "What is that? The mafia version of the Bible?"
Right.
No, it's there. I read it. Okay.
That's right.
But James, back to you. All right. You and I have had these conversations about your dreams and stuff. And when you remember, we were friends ever since email wise from 2004 after the battle
buyout. Mm-hmm.
And you struggled with your feelings over the battle of Biop, and you admitted to me that
sure.
when you were up there, you had hatred for those guys. And in your dreams, you
mm-hmm.
see their anger. And you had that same feeling. How long did it take? And I'm, again, Pacella brought this up. But like I said, 35 years from there, you're going to want to meet with these guys. You had more in common with them. You had with the truck drivers hiding behind their trucks. Because at that moment, that moment, you were locked in a battle of life and death over ideology. You didn't have a reason to hate these guys, even though you did, and they hated you. But you were locked in the battle. How long did it take you to get over that?
Well, I will tell you, the hatred came because they killed my friend Seth DeVorn. And I was very angry about that for a long time. And it took... I'm going to say probably at least 7 years. I'm just going to tell you it was at least 7 years because of the fact that even though I was going to church, even though I was, you know, had asked for forgiveness, you know, that spirit of hatred would prop itself up, you know, and I keep a picture of Seth in our home, you know. And and there were times when I'd walk in and I'd see his face and I would think, I need to go back over there. I didn't do enough. And see, I struggled with that, but I didn't take the picture down. I left the picture up because as time went on and you pray through this and beat a punching bag or, but when you started to find peace, I'd start to find peace. Then, you know, some jerk would show up in your life and try to make you mad, you know. You know, and I don't know, you know, I hate to say this, but you know, there were times when I would be so angry at people and for the most idiotic reasons. And realize that I had killed them in my heart. And that was a hard thing to deal with, you know.
No, I threw a guy down one time, and he needed to have his ass thrown down, right?
He did.
I had people
I remember that.
Up to congratulate me for that. But the thing was, I regretted it because I lost control. And I sat there and I reevaluated, why did this guy piss me off so much? And it was because he reminded me of a major I worked for who was a bully I just wanted to punch out. And I didn't know it, but subconsciously, that guy, the way he approached me, tapped into this anger I had for somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So what thinking about others have gone through, so tell us how you conquered it. How did you finally let go of your anger? And hatred.
Yeah. Yeah. It really came from prayer. And I think honestly, Rich, it's this hobby, the being outside, the metal detecting, the digging, the gardening that I do. I do that every year. I stay really busy. I mean, I can tell you that here's my day. I'm retired, but from the Army, but I'm also the national commander of the military or the Purple Heart. I run a television show called Digging History. I do two radio shows, this one and one earlier that you were on. I have a full-time job as a river museum director. And, you know, on top of that, I still make time to do, you know, volunteer work and church service. You know, we have the New Haven House of Prayer, and we do a church service every Sunday. So I think for me, it's just staying busy. It's really been my ability to stay busy and not to just lay around. I read an interesting book.
Yeah, James, that to me, when I hear people, because I know Vietnam vets the same way,
mm-hmm.
okay? And in fact, we know somebody the same way, Roger Champs. Suffered with PTSD, and the way to me, that's avoiding the issue. But
mm-hmm.
the fact is, you seem to have let go.
Yeah.
When you throw yourself into work, that's to avoid thinking about it. So when you
mm-hmm.
when you lay your head on the pillow, you're so tired and exhausted, you just pass out. You don't have time
mm-hmm.
to think about it. But I think you're at the point where you've let go. You've let go.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
that is an important step. Step into.
There's. Yeah, I let go because, there was an acknowledgement that what I did was obviously the right thing. You know, for a while, you know, I battled and thought, well, I mean, did I do the right thing? Because, you know, and I'm not just talking about the right thing as far as, you know, shooting the enemy and all that other stuff, but I'm talking about because of the conflict, you know, with other soldiers. Other American soldiers who just, you know, they really wanted to forget it, you know, not because of their suffering. They wanted to forget it because of shame, you know, and it's like, you know, that shame
will catch up with you. Let's dwell into that. Okay. So you had to deal with the issue of killing the enemy and the anger and hatred you felt with it. What about
mm-hmm.
those that were hiding behind their truck? Because you ended up commanding the company of the guys that
mm-hmm.
refused to. You commanded two truck companies in Ohio
sure.
Reserves. And one of them, these guys absolutely refused to come up to support you. And they had to come up and talk to you about that.
Yeah, some of them did. Some of them felt really bad. I don't blame the individual soldiers. I blame the command. It was a command issue. And if you remember, I'll tell you.
James, that's true.
That.
You can blame somebody else, but the reality is soldiers come back from war with this tremendous sense of guilt and shame.
Yes. Guilt
and
shame. And
guilt, you could be guilt for having taken another life. It's guilt for having fear. It's guilt
mm-hmm.
for that you lived and somebody else died.
Yeah.
Everybody comes back with this sense of guilt.
I will tell you that the bulk majority of PTSD is not warriors that killed the enemy. It is people that knows that they should have done something, but they didn't. Now, in this case, in many of these cases, they're very fortunate that no one was killed because of a lack of action or,
mm-hmm.
or whatever. But, you know, I think this just might me thinking. I think it's more difficult for men than it is women.
Yeah.
Because men have
no,
this bravado
thing. I think
thing.
Women internalize it more. No, I think I think women internalize it more. Men are
mm-hmm.
probably more out, they're probably more willing to talk about it. But I'm going to tell you this. I'm going to confirm what you said about the PTSD because as the historian, I was a source for validating PTSD claims for
mm-hmm.
Truck drivers. And so VA reps would reach out to me and are going and ask me questions. And I will tell you right now, they can't give me the names or anything, but they tell me the circumstances and they ask me to validate whether this happened or not. And
mm-hmm.
I've had a couple people who claim PTSD because of the battle biop that you were in. And I can tell you, I don't think anybody who went to the wall claimed PTSD. It's the people hiding behind their trucks. Okay.
Yeah, I don't think we did for that.
Yeah,
no.
And I have a nephew who never left. He was a Navy CB, never left the compound. He suffers PTSD because they got mortared all the time, right?
Yeah.
I tell
and
you
that
right
stinks
now, you
really
know,
bad.
When, you know, I made 5 trips over there. Mm-hmm. I got to the point where I could tell you by talking to someone, looking at them, whether they went outside the wire or not. People went outside the wire, had an entirely different attitude than those that didn't. The ones that never went outside the wire just seemed to have they lived in fear. You could sense it.
Yeah.
But the guys that went outside the wire, they were relaxed. They were comfortable.
Yeah, I mean it's. I think about being in places like Anaconda and when the incoming that recording would come on, and we were sitting in our Humvee, incoming. Okay, incoming. Well, I mean I'm just as safe here, sitting here, rather than running to one of these concrete bunkers that's, a couple hundred yards away. It's like I'll probably get hit between there and then there and here, But you'd watch people; they'd just run, and we would be sitting there watching the, because they had a lot of airbursts. I don't know if you know that, but they
I didn't
know
that. No, no.
Yeah, they had a lot of airbursts when I was there, and they would just blow up above the ground, and I guess they were timing these things, but I just remember we were kind of watching it like fireworks. And
my attitude about incoming,
we're just running.
Now in Vietnam, you talk to a guy in Vietnam, I mean, it was a hail of rockets or mortars. I mean, it was barrages. But in Iraq and Afghanistan, it was 2 or 3 rockets. Okay.
Yeah.
And the thing about it is, the way I looked at it, my first mortar attack was in Panama, and I heard the booming sound. It was muffled because it missed us. Our headquarters was on a hill. So if it missed us, it dropped down the hill and it landed when it was surrounded by jungles. So the sound was muffled. It was not like a normal incoming round. And it sounded to me like thunder. And I remember looking out the window. I heard the 2 booms, and I looked out the window. I'm like, sure doesn't look like rain. And then I heard people talk about incoming. I'm like, oh, that's what it was. And then I was at Anaconda when it was Mortaritaville, and the sirens went off 5 times while I was there. And the closest rocket attack I had was at Bagram in Afghanistan. And, I remember because in my infantry training, we had to, they put us in a bunker and they had artillery, called artillery in this. So you could see it and feel it. And it had that, there's always that crump sound. I was used to outgoing mail was boom, 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 the cannon, boom, boom, boom. Incoming was crump, crump, crump. Until I was in Bagram and I heard that crump sound. I'm like, shit, that's incoming. Next thing I know, it was like, boom. And I'm going, oh, it's crump when it's like away from you. But when it's within 100 yards, it's a boom sound.
Oh, yeah.
And the thing was, though, is like, they come in Iraq and Afghanistan. They're 2 or 3 rounds that come in. It's like, it's over. I mean, you can't sweat it. It's like, it's over. If you hear it, you're alive. And I had one friend of mine, Major Ira Baldwin. I went over to visit him at Taji, and he took me over to the Haji Mart. And they had the trailers, and they had these T-barriers, these concrete T-barriers. And he showed me, he takes me over there, show me how he got his combat action badge, his CAB. He said, because you have to be within 100 meters of contact or something like that. He goes, he was walking over to the tailors. He hit behind the T-barrier, and he shows me the divot in the concrete pad where the rocket hits. And if he had 2 seconds earlier, it would have killed him because he would have been like Bobby Plummet. You know, the fact that where it landed, he had just stepped behind the tee barrier to go into the Haji bar. And the thing was, his attitude is like, here, look, I CAB, here, look, this is it. This is how close I was to death. He wasn't stressed out because of it. I've never heard him ever talk about it. For him, it's like, I finally got it. And I'll tell you, I heard this story when I went up to Spiker and what was the one above it?
Diamondback.
Missoula.
Diamondback.
I can't remember the name of it. Yeah. But anyway, so they were talking to these guys. It was a story of this one kid who couldn't stay awake. He just couldn't stay awake, and all the convoys were at night. So it was a short convoy, and see, everybody wanted to get their combat action badge. And finally, so it's like a short convoy. They put him on it. That was the ASV, the M1117. And sure enough, an IED goes off next to it, and they survive. And the guy gets out, and he's jumping up and down. He's so excited. I finally got my CAB. So, anyway, we have those stories. People handle stress differently. So back to your monologue. So we've addressed the fact that you have let go now, but that was a process. Now, the other thing I want to address is, there's more than one side to a story.
Mm-hmm.
And when we had this, the first discussed the Ukraine issue, and I'm going to admit I was wrong because I predicted that Putin would not be stupid enough to invade Ukraine proper, to occupy the breakaway republics in the eastern part of Ukraine. That made sense because he could roll his troops in there with no opposition. But to invade Ukraine would lead to another Afghanistan. I'm talking about the Russian Afghanistan. Well, I'm correct about that. It led to a Russian Afghanistan. I didn't believe he's stupid enough to do it, but I suspect his military advisors had told him, we're going to pull this off. We'll have Kiev. We'll overrun Kiev in 3 days. Well, they were wrong. In fact, I heard on the news today that Putin has now modified they're into negotiations. He's modified he's telling everybody his only goal is just to annex the breakaway republic. He has no intention of occupying Ukraine, which means that's a face-saving way of being able to pull out of Ukraine and say, well, we never planned to take it in the first place. But here's the issue. This is what I brought up. Putin has been consistent since 1994, do not admit Ukraine to NATO. Do not put a threat on his border. He's been consistent. And I'm sure there's Russians and Serbians who believe the same way. You know, if you look at the history of Russia and Germany, the countries in between have always been buffer states. Now, France and Germany share a border. They're used to having an enemy on their border, but not Russia. So Ukraine to NATO is an aggressive act. And from if you go through the history of Russia, you can't see it any other way. Now, we're looking at it from Western European eyes that anybody who wants to embrace democracy should be able to be independent and do that and be a member of the EU and be a member of Ukraine, NATO. But Russia sees it there. You've got to see it through the eyes of Russia. That is an act of aggression. And the fact that our administration did not take that off the table, that our administration has an adversarial, Biden has an adversarial relation with Russia, but not China. Tell me I'm wrong. Tell me I'm wrong. No, you're right. Okay? China owns Biden, but Russia doesn't. So Russian, now, you know, remember Biden's telling everybody how, the Democrats are like, oh, Russia owns Trump and stuff like that. Hey, we didn't have a problem. We had a problem with Russia and Ukraine when Obama was the president. We have a problem with Russia and Ukraine when Biden's president. What's the consistency here? Trump did not want to antagonize Russia. Biden and Obama did. And now we're on the brink of World War III. Okay? Now here's the issue. It's already started. Okay? This probably could have been avoided if we just listened to what Russia was saying, but we didn't care. We're not taking it off the table, but had we just taken it off the table, we probably wouldn't have this problem. But we want to create an adversarial relationship with Russia. We now have it.
Right.
The problem is,
no doubt.
Now it's just gotten so bad, we actually have to take sides. And here's the thing. So I can understand those people who are coming on social media or whatever and saying, no, you guys are the aggressors. Because in a way we are. They see us that way. I'm going to tell you this. Not all Russians and Serbs see it that way. There are Russians who are speaking out against this. There are Russians who are risking 15 years in prison to protest against this war. All right? And I just read today, they're estimating that 10 to 15,000 Russians have died in this war in a month. Hmm. 10 to 15,000 died. And if you do the math, that, you know, usually the casualty rate, the wounded rate, is three times that number. So while Putin can suppress the news and have them avoid talking about the cost of this invasion, you got 10 to 15,000 casualties, I mean, dead. How do you hide that? Now, this is now North Vietnam. Yes, they did hide it. During the Vietnam War, you know, it's like your son was to the Army and you never heard from him again. You have no idea what happened to him because his body never returned. No one ever told you what happened. But I don't think that's the case in Russia. And I think, you know, and you're talking about what about the wounded? You know, the word is probably getting back to the Russians. All right. And you're talking about what it was, how many Russians were involved in the invasion of Ukraine? Was it 100 or 300,000? Do you remember the number?
No, I don't.
170, 180,000.
Okay. So if you're looking at 10 to 15,000, you're almost looking at close to 10% of that army is dead. 10%? Those are high casualties.
Can I go back and mention something about the fragility of the psyche and some of the psychological injuries? You know, when we did Lieutenant Colonel that lost the 111 soldiers, and we talked about the importance of penance, how, you know, he went around receiving accolades and giving speeches, but he could have been doing something more constructive as regards his healing and as regards...
Oh, you're talking about Whitley. Whitley with the Lost Battalion. Got it.
Right, and helping the families who lost those people. I think when we talk about healing process, and James, you know, you talked about your particular way that God directed you and things that you did that brought about your healing. And even though were doing something like the Ukrainians are, who have taken up arms, even as civilians, you still have an aftermath psychologically and spiritually, because it's not normal. I think I told you David Grossman's book on killing. He said there's only about 3% cold-blooded killers. And that's when he talked about the need for conditioning and the different wars and so on and so forth. But people are injured psychologically and spiritually, even more than physically. And I think that's where the healing process has to come, where we are repairing. We are doing what we can to bring healing, even though we didn't intentionally and deliberately do the injury. You know, we were a part of a team trying to overthrow a violent, wicked person. But when you come out of that, even people who have seen horrible things, like car accidents with people all mangled up and everything, there's an aftermath. And so I think we need to be looking at how do we heal this person. I listened to Tony Robbins the other day, and he was talking about some people he's been working with PTSD, and how they couldn't reconnect with their families, their children, and how he has seen some pretty miraculous things. Ironically, he went to some kind of a medical conference that the Pope hosted. I guess he was one of the speakers, how people have overcome some tremendous things. But I believe that there are people that are crippled psychologically. They're injured morally. This moral injury is something that we're talking a lot about when we talk about suicide among veterans. And I really think that that's what we have to focus on, not necessarily looking at who was right or trying to rationalize anything or make ourselves feel better about it, but we were never made, okay? We're hardwired to love and be compassionate. Certainly there's the fight and the flight, okay, instinct. But I think that we just have a lot of crippled people who have been injured morally, and that's where the salve and the healing has to come. And so I think going back to Rich's thing of meeting your enemies 35 years later, just like we talked about the person from the movie in the book Unbroken, is part of the healing process. You didn't hate them. You were defending your life. You were defending the life of the other soldiers. You're defending the honor of your country. But you look at someone, you know, in Vietnam, the big thing was, you know, calling people gooks and, you know, depersonalizing them. But they have families. They have children. They have wives. They have husbands, so on and so forth. And I really think we have to dig deeper when we want to heal people from this trauma, because we just were not created to live outside of peace. You know, there is a time for war and a time for peace, and we don't want to be naive about the tumultuous life. But even in some of our cities where children are being murdered, this is not the way things were supposed to be. This leaves us wrecked emotionally. And this is where I feel like people who have hardened themselves and won't let you touch them, you know, in the inner person and even God healing their memories. Not that you don't remember anymore. I'm not talking about spiritual shock treatment, but I'm talking about God being able to heal your memories. And even though you still remember it, it doesn't have the same effect of making you live it over again. And a lot of that comes through prayer. You know, you're not going to forget it. Okay, God certainly forgets our sins, but the impact of the etching in your brain or the smell that you still remember will be lifted and not be as difficult. And I think we need to go there if we're going to reconcile and then get to the place where, yeah, let me meet these people. That might be good for them and for me as well. But I have to meet myself before I meet others and face those such horrible things. And see, the reason why we do dream is a lot of people won't face them, so they won't have a day vision per se, or a hallucination, if you will. But it's almost like there are certain things that we have to confront, and only when we're sleeping are we vulnerable enough to confront those things. That's why we have reoccurring dreams. And sooner or later, you've got to make a decision in your heart in those dreams so that you're free from that torment.
Well, that explains a lot about my dreams, then. Now, you know, I'm gonna have a confession right now. I'm going to say, people I hurt that I wanted to hurt, I have absolutely no regret from it. None whatsoever. It's like everybody, it's like they deserve what I gave them. And you probably, you know, Father Michael, you know, you've known me for 22 years, and you know pretty much how controlled. If, you know, I am like the nicest guy you'll ever meet until I'm not the nicest guy, okay? But what haunts me are those people I hurt that I had absolutely no intention of hurting. People who wanted things from me that I couldn't or wouldn't give them. People I unintentionally hurt by just callousness or inadvertent, you know, just not thinking or my own selfishness. That's what I regret. And it's interesting because you said the dream, because there's times I like to just sit there and listen to jazz and drink wine and purge myself of my feelings. So I think maybe that's healthy, all right? So I have let that go. So my dreams are weird dreams, all right? Actually, one of the most common dreams I have is being back on an SF-18. It's like I had more time than most people. I got 18 months. And it was because I was gone all the time. As soon as I come back from a mission, I was out on another mission. And a recurring dream I have is I'm trying to get on another. I'm either trying to get on a team or get. I know I'm gone. I know I'm history. I'm going to get shipped out or something. I'm going to get forced into retirement. Whatever. If I can just get on one mission, I'll be safe. It's me reaching out, trying to get one more mission so I can have that fun. But anyway, my brother, he was a Marine, gunnery sergeant in 1st Battalion, 1st Regiment, 1st Division, Marine Division in Desert Storm, Task Force Papa Bear, reached through the trenches, drove all the way into Kuwait City. The only guys he killed were there was 5 Iraqis in civilian clothes. They were driving one night, though the whole battalion was rolling down the road, and this pickup, the white Toyota pickup, pulled up, and the Iraqis got out to surrender to him. So the convoy stopped. He got out and walked forward, and he had a what we'd call a quick draw holster for his 45, and Doug was a good shot. He spent a year. He was a year on range detail on Okinawa, and he got really good. Because before that, seriously, I could outshoot him. It was easy, and I'd make fun of me being in the Army. And I don't think we ever did target practice afterwards to find out how good he really was, but I knew he was good. So he walked forward. There's 5 Iraqi civilians there. They drew on him as he was walking forward, and he admitted that he managed to get, and he knew he dropped to his knee, dropped the first one, emptied, I think, 5 magazines, and dropped another one, okay? His driver said he believes he dropped a third one, and so the other 2 were killed by the rest of the guys. And he was caught in this crossfire. that haunted him. That, I mean, I was the first person he confessed that story to after he come back, and he said it was hard for him to talk about it. And every now and then he would get melancholy and drinking and blubbering, and he'd call his mother and talk to her about it. That for years, decades after that, he still struggled with killing those guys. And he's this big, tough Marine gunnery sergeant, okay? And as always, Joe, my that one thing that pissed him off was one time my little brother who didn't serve, he goes, because of this Marine Corps-Army rivalry, he made a comment that I was more of a soldier than Doug was. And, of course, he got pissed off. And what Hugh was really trying to say was Doug's bravado was external. Mine was internal. That was the difference. Doug, all this toughness was on the surface. He was very vulnerable inside. And killing those two guys, those two Iraqis, revealed that. And he told me, he said he got called in the battalion afterwards, battalion or regiment. And they told him that turns out those five Iraqis in civilian clothes were Iraqi hitmen. These are the guys going around shooting anybody who's going to defect. He said, you killed real, not just Iraqi soldiers, you killed really bad guys. These are assassins. And he still struggles with that, right? And he admitted once he turned to religion, he becomes a lay preacher in his latter days. And I remember him quoting a few Bible scriptures where he said he found peace. He found peace because, you know, in the scriptures, it basically told him to just let go of it, okay? And I think that's what, you know, Father Michael is talking about. And I think, James, I think when you, you know, when I asked you about what it took for you to let go of it, you found the same thing. It was your belief that you're forgiven.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, there, I would agree with that, yeah. Father Michael, now I want to try to transition into this because I do want to talk about the World War II generation. Now, I had an uncle that was a POW, and to the day he died, he never made peace that I'm aware of, you know, with the Japanese. Never. And I never could understand. This is in the late 70s. I remember us walking into a store and he would spit on Japanese made cars. You know, never was able to forgive. And
I can answer that question for you real easy. For two reasons. First of all, I saw a study of war propaganda posters, the war and posters. And if you looked at the war posters when it was dealing with Germany, we were not fighting the German people. We were fighting Nazis. The German people were good people. They were just like us. We were not fighting Germans. We were fighting Nazis. But in the Pacific, we were fighting Japs, and they were evil people. The whole, if you look at all the propaganda, the posters, the Japanese people were evil people. Now, once you got to fight them, you found out they were, you know, that they borrowed the worst of the samurai tradition. They were ruthless. They were merciless. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's all right. Let me put it this way, because you want to know who surprised me that had the most compassion for the Japanese? Everybody I know that fought the Japanese hated them, wouldn't buy a Jap car, none of that. And I use the term Jap. Oh, I mentioned that I was teaching a class, a bunch of captains and stuff, and one female captain comes up. your use of the term Jap offended me. And then I started rattling off all the other offensive names I could think, Kraut, you know, Kike, all this other stuff I could say. And I'm like, I use all these terms. The thing is, I have a great appreciation for Japanese culture. I teach Aikido. I understand the best aspects of Japanese. But World War II, that was the worst aspect of Japanese culture. They were Japs. Okay, if anybody out there listening is offended by the term Jap, Nip, whatever you want, call them son of a bitches, that's exactly what they were. All right, they promoted bullies. They encouraged bullies. Now, the good Japs, they didn't rise up in rank, okay? And what surprised me is I got to talk to a New Mexico National Guard unit was activated. It was anti-aircraft artillery, got activated, hit to the Philippines. They had no ammo, got, and of course, they're part of the surrender. And I'm talking to this guy, and I'm used to everybody I've grown up with absolutely hated Japs. And he had nothing bad to say about him. And I'm like, and I confronted him with that. He goes, I'm alive because of the good Japanese. I mean, here's a guy who's a prisoner of war, faced all the atrocities. They were going to kill these guys. You know, you look at what they did to the American prisoners of war. He goes, but what he remembered was the good ones. There were good ones. And he's alive because of them. The rest of them, you know, everybody else that had to fight, you look at how hard the Japanese fought. Of course. You know, they're cruel. I mean, I'm reading Sledge's book with the old breed. And he mentions there, like, why won't they quit? They know they're going to lose. Why won't they quit? They keep fighting. They're surrounded. They won't stop fighting until they kill you or they're dead. So
I went to a museum.
The Americans who fought in the Pacific had plenty of reason to hate the Japs.
I went to a museum in Korea. As you know, they were under the domination of the Japanese from 1910 to 1945.
Right.
And they showed some real cruel little cages that they were kept in, and you know they were stripped of their culture, their language,
yeah,
different things of that nature. And they said at the end of it, we don't want to be resentful, we just don't want to ever forget it. And so most definitely we all have that potential of being so wicked and inhumane. And so, you know, some people look at a particular people, whether it be the Native American or the Germans or the Japanese, but really we all have that proclivity and that inclination to be evil that way. And, you know,
a lot of it has to do with poor leadership.
Good
and evil. And the question is, what do we want? Which side are we going to give into? See,
that's right.
I'm teaching that now. I'm covering that now. You know, the period of 1870 to 1914. And when you look at Japan, it's the Meiji era in which they abolished, you know, it's the end of the shogunate, and they outlaw samurai. But as they militarized, as they embraced, you know, Western culture, Western uniforms, everything, industrialization, and they do it very rapidly because they're able to beat the Russians on a naval battle, okay? But the thing is, as they go in, you know, the problem is then they reevaluate, because I'm studying about the Bushido and Budo, and from the martial arts aspect, because there's three really good books that I'm reading on that, and written by a U.S. Army, U.S. Marine. And it's about, as they are now, the Japanese are reevaluating, okay, what are the aspects of our samurai, our shogun culture that we want to preserve? And unfortunately, going into World War II, they decided to preserve the worst aspect. after we dropped the bomb on them, they decided to preserve the best aspect of it. So, yes, there is good and there's evil. And
Rich,
they unfortunately had embraced the evil side, and now they're, you know, I have nothing but admiration for the Japanese people.
But could you share with us about the Japanese Bataan Death March?
Going into World War II, were,
can you share with us about the Bataan Death March? My friend Jim Newsom's father was in it, and he was 75 pounds. He met his wife because she was a nurse that restored him. But I don't know if James's uncle was a part of that or not, but I've heard horrendous things about the few survivors and the Bataan Death March. Can you kind of elaborate a little bit since we're talking about the good and the evil?
It was horrible. The thing is, first of all, the defenders of Bataan were already starving. They were out of everything. They could have kept fighting. If they had the food and ammo, they could have held out. And you got to understand, I'm going to tell the positive side of them before we talk. You know, we look at like, okay, they surrendered. They surrendered in Bataan surrendered in May, April, and I think Corregidor surrendered in May. Every other country, British Empire, whatever, that the Japanese invaded, surrendered within a month. Bataan was the last holdout. Now, there's a number of mistakes MacArthur made. But the fact is, guys surrendered. Oh, because my focus is the guys that didn't surrender. The guys that decided to, hey, I'm going to go and escape out of here and live with the Filipinos. And they end up becoming guerrilla leaders. That's who I was studying. But of course, I've read the accounts of some of the guys who were in part of the death march. The thing is, the Japanese culture, the samurai culture, is that it is honorable to die. You take your own life if you have to. To die in battle is honorable. To fight to the death is honorable, right? To surrender is dishonorable. That was the bad aspect of the samurai culture that they adopted. So here is these arms. You know, the Japanese generals are trying to talk these guys into surrendering so they don't have to fight them. But the mere fact they surrendered made the Japanese soldiers look down on them as cowards, unworthy of any kind of sympathy and stuff. Now, let me tell you. You did not want to have any Japanese souvenirs on you when you were in a death march, so they would search you. If you had so much as a Japanese cigarette or something like that, cigarette lighter, they would execute you because they knew you got that from a dead Japanese. Okay, they were looking for excuses to execute Americans and Filipinos. And then the other part of it, so they're already looking down on you because you're a coward. You're not worthy of living. You're below a slave because you have surrendered. You should have fought to the death. Even the irony of it is, okay, you wanted us to surrender, and now you're going to treat us like we're cowards because we surrendered? Okay. But there's also the theory that, well, they didn't have the capable of handling that many prisoners. So in the march to the prison camps was a death march. It was really everybody's emaciated. They're already hungry. And they just marched them and to just kill them off. And if anybody staggered or whatever, they would stab them. And I have counts of people who actually survived that they've now pointed out that they're wasn't that, you know, you talk about that many Japanese along the route. There wasn't that many. It's not like they had it well guarded. And so a few guys decided, screw this, I'm running. Okay. One guy stumbled, failed. Japs stabbed him but didn't kill him. And they left him for dead. And the Filipinos recovered him and nursed him back to health. But, yes, that march, the death march, was deliberately to kill off the Americans to reduce their numbers. And they were deliberately starved. They kept weak in the prison camps in order so that they wouldn't escape. And I asked this guy, that New Mexico National Guard veteran, why he never tried to escape. And he said, because the Japanese told us, if one of us escapes, they will kill a certain number of Americans for us. So it's like, now it's a case of you have to stay there. You don't want anyone to escape, so because you might be the next guy killed, or you don't want to escape because they're going to take it out on your friends. And that's how cruel the Japs were.
Yeah, that was my point. Because I know, talking to my friend, even, you know, how mean-spirited his dad was and stuff because of all the atrocities that he experienced personally. And, you know, just to think how ruthless we can be. You think about, as James was talking about earlier, the concentration camps and all the deaths and, you know, and you were talking about the Greatest Generation and what they went through in preparation as far as the depression and things. James, I like the correlation you made there. Can you elaborate on that, please, with us?
I wonder if he's in the green room.
We were talking about, you know, all that those World War II veterans went through in preparation, and especially through the Great Depression and a lot of hardship. And I know some of my uncles were there for like 4 years, you know, so it wasn't 13 months and come home. You know, they really, really had to stay until it was finished. And certainly everybody dealt with it differently. But the aftermath had a great impact on our whole culture.
Yeah, no, I have a cousin. He was a Vietnam vet, but he grew up. He would not buy a Japanese car, okay, because mm-hmm. he was old enough to, he's 10 years older than me. He was old enough mm-hmm. to still be a product of that propaganda, all right? We were fighting the Japanese people. We were fighting in the Pacific, we were fighting Nazis in Europe. So we could be friends with Germans, but we can't be friends with Japs, okay? But the Japs were tough. They were seriously tough. They fought, you know, they weren't going to surrender. They fought to the death. And my mentor, who is a Marine and then went to the Army, and, yeah, but once a Marine, always a Marine, and he never let go. That served on Okinawa, went to Vietnam in 65. He pointed out that the Japanese that actually surrendered were those who were drafted late in the war, who didn't have that samurai culture.
How about the kamikaze pilot?
Well, okay. Now, that's interesting because the style of Aikido I train under was founded by Akira Tohei. And my sensei, the guy I trained under, Pat Crosby, was a longtime student. Actually, it was Akira Tohei's best student, so when he went around to do demonstrations and stuff, he always took Pat with him to do the throws. And he would tell me that Akira Tohei's career ambition was to fly a plane into an American ship. Mm-hmm. He was trained to be a kamikaze pilot, and he never got to fulfill his lifelong ambition because Japan ran out of airplanes. And so after the war, he was lost. he had no purpose in life because his purpose in life was to fly a plane into an American battleship or whatever and kill lots of Americans. And so he's wandering lost, and his cousin is one of the great practitioners. Koichi Tohei is one of the great practitioners of Aikido, and so he goes and he starts studying Aikido, and it gives him a new purpose in life. And then he realizes, if anybody knows about Koichi Tohei and Ki Society, it becomes ridiculous. He would always joke, he said, he was perfect. And there's only one direction you can go when you're perfect, and that's down. And so there's a lot of criticism of Ki Society Aikido. But Aikido gave Koichi Tohei new direction. And where his lifelong, the irony is, his lifelong ambition was to fly a plane into an American ship and kill Americans. He was tasked to bring Aikido to America. Now, keep in mind, it was Yamada who was the first. He goes into the New York area. Satomi is the second. He comes over and he goes into Florida. Chiba goes to the West Coast. And Akira Tohei goes to Chicago, and he ends up living the rest of his life in Chicago.
Interesting. But I mean,
yeah, it is. It is.
Mindset.
I mean, the style of Aikido I'm training under was taught by a kamikaze pilot. And he was serious about this. You know, he had no remorse about it. When Pat would tell me about it, it's like he still regrets he didn't fly a plane into
the Can I tell you a story?
He's living in America. And he's like, I still regret it. I didn't fulfill my obligation.
Sorry, Rich. I was on the task
Go
force
ahead.
Carrier, and we were the flagship. And all of a sudden, something was coming at us. We were not involved in flight operations. We had the first Marine Corps Squadron, VMA 224, out of Cherry Point, North Carolina, in the Vietnam War. It was another plane from another carrier that got lost. And so my officers and everybody were freaking out, you know, because they thought it was something that was going to come and attack us. And it was just another jet, another plane from another carrier. And finally, it was able to land. It had just gotten lost. So I can imagine what people would have gone through, especially something as large as a carrier, if something was coming at them, you know, to kind of blow the whole thing up, and even a smaller ship, as you said.
Okay. So there are a lot of American Aikidoists who trained under this kamikaze pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and they train me, and they've trained a lot of other people. Okay, and Aikido is a martial art that is designed to spread peace throughout the world. So, you know, it is what it is. When I start talking about the World War II Japanese, I refer to them as Japs because that's what they were. If it's derogatory, I mean it that way. But when I talk about the post-World War II Japanese, I speak of reverence with them. I have great admiration for the culture.
Well, even though
a student of that culture.
Even those who suffered birth defects because of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I think in our humanity, we have concerned about the aftermath and even birth defects later on with those who were innocent and were just people from the civilian population. And so, no, we have to have compassion on everyone. But I'm just showing you how each of us can be vicious and can be virtuous.
Yeah.
Like you said, now he uses it to bring about peace and to show, you know, how you can use the pressure of another person against them and so forth. Yes.
Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you, I guess in the theme of, we've strayed off. We never even talked about the World War II generation. We haven't talked about depression and stuff like that. But I think the conversation we're having is how to deal with the past. How to, you know, like I said, I've never killed anybody. I was an officer, okay? Most of the time I'm advising everybody. I'm rolling on convoys as a historian, all right? My regrets is hurting people I didn't intend to hurt. James had to struggle with he killed people, okay? And he struggled for several years. My brother struggled with that. Akira Tohei, he never got to fulfill his ambition of killing a bunch of Americans by flying a plane into it. But yet he comes to America. Pat told me that the only thing he complained about living in America, because he was used to the train system running on time, and like the public transportation did not run on time in Chicago, okay? That's the only complaint he had. But he spent the rest of his life, you know, teaching Americans. He had embraced, you know, Mori Iwashiba's philosophy, you know, not just the martial art, but the philosophy that went with it. So I guess, you know, if there's a lesson from tonight's show is we can be forgiven, all right? So with my brother, with James, with myself, Father Michael, I don't know what you've had to struggle with, you know, that you've confessed,
but we've all failed. Like you said,
by Christ dying, look, God is pure love. That's the thing. God is pure love. Christ died on, it's not like we have to ask for forgiveness. We have to accept it. That's it. We were already forgiven. God is pure love. Christ died for us. We don't have to ask for forgiveness. We are forgiven. All we have to do is accept it. And I think all of us who are on this show have struggled with these issues. And when we finally accept it, that forgiveness, then we can move on.
Yeah, and I think it's important to acknowledge, you know, what we've done and accept that forgiveness and then know that we're not greater than God, that if God has forgiven us because of the great price he paid by sending Jesus to die and suffer for us, and then we have to let it go, as you were saying earlier. You know, if somebody's paid your debts and you're indebted to them, well, you can show some kind of gratitude. But you can't keep denying the fact that they paid your debt. It's paid in full. And, you know, it's hard to believe sometimes that somebody would be so good, it wasn't their debt, but they paid your debt. But rather than say I'm not worthy of it.
That reminds me. See, here's an issue. Because I was thinking about it, and I said, all right, what about the people who don't believe in God, who don't believe Jesus died for us? So how do they accept forgiveness? They have to actually go to in person and ask forgiveness or forgive, tell them they're forgiven. You know, we talked about that, you know, you killed my daughter, so I go and I tell you, you're forgiven. Because I'm letting go, because I can't torture myself.
Right.
But, all right, so if you don't believe in God, you don't believe in Jesus, then you have to actually go and meet everybody that haunts you and have to ask their forgiveness or forgive them. But the fact that if you believe that Jesus died for your sins and God is pure love, you can just accept it.
And that's why Jesus could say, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. You know, those who are killing him. And, you know, he could go to God And that's what turned the heart of one of the fellow criminals that he was being crucified with. He at first was also, you know, kind of throwing insults at Jesus. But then
no,
when he saw...
I don't think that. He comes into the story because the other guy was thrown in. The reason I love
no, no,
that story
if you look at all
because...
the Gospels together... No, no, all the Gospels, read. You have to read all the Gospels together.
Oh, okay.
And you'll see that he was also involved in insulting. But he saw
so what
something.
What changed his mind? Okay.
Probably the way Jesus died and the way he forgave. Because
okay.
even the soldier said, truly, you were this. He was the Son of God. The way he died,
yeah.
you know, they didn't have to break his legs, and the way... You know, he was compassionate, worrying about his mother and all the beautiful things he did. I'm studying right now because I'll do it on Good Friday, the seven last words of Christ on the cross. And just a beautiful, beautiful thing. And when a person can witness that, when they know that they're being punished for what they did rightly, but that you were innocent, that converted one of them, but the other one did not convert.
Well, I always like to point that out because, as you know, I was originally raised as a Baptist and a Pentecostal. And as a Baptist, you have to be – your baptism doesn't count unless you're fully immersed, fully immersed. You, sprinkling water doesn't count, okay? I always like to refer to the man on the cross.
Yeah.
He did
absolutely.
Three things. What did he say? Tell me what he did to, because Jesus said, this day we will meet in paradise.
Right,
what did he
right.
do? He didn't get baptized. I guarantee you that. He didn't get baptized.
No.
What did he do?
No, he confessed innocence.
So first
of Christ,
he admitted that Jesus was the Son of God.
Yes.
That was the first thing. He realized Jesus was the Son of God.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then?
Well, he asked him, you know, to remember me when you come to your kingdom.
But he admitted he was, because he was telling the other guy, we're sinners. He admitted
that's right.
he was a
we're,
sinner.
We're, and he
that,
was innocent.
That
Jesus
man
innocent.
Doesn't deserve to be here. That man is,
that's
and
right.
he, the fact that he realizes he's the Son of God, he goes, I'm a sinner. We are sinners. We deserve this
mm-hmm.
punishment. But that guy
right.
right there doesn't deserve to be up here. He is a living, mm-hmm. he realized he's a living Son of God. And then
right.
he asked God for forgiveness. He was never mm-hmm. baptized. And yet
right.
Jesus told him that he would see him in paradise.
Today you'll be with me. That's right. That's right. I mean, that's
yeah.
the exception, of course. But
that,
certainly
that is
no
salvation
question.
In its simplest terms
yep.
right there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's why we've talked about this, about deathbed conversions. A person really can surrender when they're suffering, and God is that merciful, you know, where they have to go to purgatory and get cleaned up a little bit before they're able to go into God's presence.
Well, you know, look, I identify with Emanuel Swedenborg, and I'm going like, well, that means you're going to spend a long time in purgatory trying to sort that out, okay? Now that I'm a believer in purgatory, the place between heaven and hell, that
mm-hmm.
– yeah, you may convert, but the thing is, that just means you're not going directly to hell. You really have
that's
to
right.
now sort out good from
mm-hmm.
evil, all right? If
I,
the preponderance of your soul is
it.
Leaning towards evil, that's where you're going.
James mentioned the book by Mitch Albom, The Five People You'll Meet in Heaven. If
yep.
you ever saw the film, it's really reconciling things before you go to heaven in purgatory, like getting right with his dad and all these
right.
other things. I
right.
love the movie.
Mm-hmm. Great
the
movie.
Book I have. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
But you really have to get things in order. It's not like all of a sudden, you know, you and I've said this before about
when you say get things in order, what I advocate is, no, it is, look, when we talk about being born again, and you think of an infant, now you begin to grow. To be born
right.
again means now you begin to grow.
That's right.
I was raised a Baptist. To be baptized means you're going to heaven. I don't think
mm-hmm.
so. I
right.
don't believe that anymore. okay? I don't believe in, you know, salvation by faith alone. I believe you actually have to convert. You have to change. You have to start, you know, you have to do acts with love. You have to use love to perform. Love by itself is meaningless unless there's acts with it.
That's right.
And
well,
that process changes you. Okay.
Faith without works is dead. And John the Baptist said, show fruit of your repentance. You know, I had a very rough relationship with my dad. And, you know, he was 100% disabled vet, you know, in jail, in prison, and in the psychiatric ward, in VA. And that part in that movie really spoke to me because, you know, he died at 54 and we never had much of a relationship. He signed me into the military but I do think that, you know, God is relational, and I do think that, you know, faith without works, in other words, I can't hate my father. One time I preached on forgiveness. I didn't bring my Bible. This is many years ago. I brought a picture of my father. And you know, if we don't let God heal us and heal them, we're not going to be ready to live in God's presence forever.
All right. I'm going to change the subject. Okay. You and Doreen were absolutely handsome when you were young. Okay. You posted that photo on Facebook. I'm like, yo, now I know why you fell in love with her.
Okay. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. All I saw that picture. I was going to ask you about that picture, Father Michael.
One of my friends said I go into
Father Michael's office and I see the portraits of him. They're much later. That's when you guys were young. My God.
That's our engagement picture. Yep, 1975.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Destiny's putting pictures together because she wants to display them at the wedding. And we wanted our wedding picture, which is really nice, but she liked that picture, and she colorized it. And I posted it. But, she's a beauty, but she's a woman of God. She's an inside out. But I always tell my friends
let's just address that. Okay, so see, you raised Catholic and you went into the Navy and then you were born again and then you meet up with Doreen.
Spiritual.
All right. Yeah. So, but Doreen seems to have been raised in a godly environment. So is she really the structure behind your faith?
No, I had a real dramatic conversion, and I was filled with the Holy Spirit, and speaking in tongues. I didn't even know what it was. I had a dramatic experience.
Which is common among Pentecostals, among other.
This was
other
while in the Navy.
Denomination.
Tuesday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon in a library, and I saw a great light, and the Lord just encountered me. And I think she saw my zeal. She had a lot more character from her upbringing, and you know, she was solid. A couple years older than me at that point in time, she was more educated than I was. And so a real gift from God. You know, the Bible says that houses and wealth are from fathers. I got none of that. But a prudent wife is from the Lord. And so we've been a great team, and God has been merciful to me. But thank you for your compliment about the picture. I appreciate it.
No, that's a great photo. I've seen several photos. That's the best I've seen.
We still think we look like that. You know, it's funny when you talk to each other, you don't realize. You look in the mirror and say, man, I've changed. Yeah, things have changed. But, you know, you still have each other in your mind.
Here's
like
about
the way you
marriage counseling. And, you know, here's these two couples. They can't stand each other. And he said, don't say anything. Just stare into each other's lives. Just sit there for like however, you know, many minutes. Just stare into each other's eyes. The thing is, while your physical body changes, your eyes never do. And as the couple are standing there staring at each other, they're like, they just immediately fall in love and they embrace each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's a comedy show, but it's funny because it's like, yeah, you're too busy, distracted, and looking at the externals, the rest of the body. But when you look at the eyes, you see the person you fell in love with.
Yeah. Yeah, my wife's got big blues for an Italian. That's an unusual thing. And she was blonde.
Yeah, that would
she was younger. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But the Lord is good. And there are many blessings, many of our friendships, our families, and different people who God has put in our lives as we journey together in sometimes a very hard journey. And if it weren't for certain people, you know, when our daughter passed, my wife said the only worst thing could have happened is if one of us died. You know, that's the beauty of what
yeah.
God gives us in covenant and sacramental relationship.
Well, we're down to about the last 6 minutes here. Parting thoughts?
Yeah, I love what you said.
The only thing I can say is the amount of time we have is, I think most of our listeners are the same listeners over and over. So if I say go to Amazon and look up Kilblaine or Michael Pagella books. If you haven't already looked at it, you're probably not going to do it, okay? But I do have a book coming out in May on the Rough Riders, Teddy Roosevelt's Rough Riders. And I think this is going to be as good as The Filthy 13. Yeah, Filthy 13 is my most popular book right now. This is the style of writing I have. The feedback I get from people is that I write from the soldier's perspective. And this is definitely written from the soldier's perspective. It all the other books out there on the Rough Riders are really written about Teddy Roosevelt, and they sprinkle in a few first-person accounts from soldiers who served under him. But no,